From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Life After Welfare, we talk with Jason DeParle of the New York Times. He's just completed a year-long study of Wisconsin, the state that has come closest to the goal of ending welfare. DeParle says it offers the rest of the country a preview of changes to come. Singer and songwriter Marshall Crenshaw is known for writing pop songs with catchy hooks. He'll perform some of the songs from his new CD, number 447. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has spent another day at peace talks between Israel and Syria. Today, for the first time, he met with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Syrian Foreign Minister Farouk al-Sharaa at the same time. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The key issues in the talks are the return of the Golan Heights to Syria and security guarantees for Israel. President Clinton said he believes both sides are very serious and both want an agreement. The president said any comprehensive Middle East peace will need financial help from the U.S. to work.
We're attempting to ascertain what the general outlines of the costs would be, over how many years those costs can be spread, and then I will have to do some serious consultation with the congressional leadership.
The president said Europe and Asia will also have to contribute to economic development in the Middle East to guarantee any peace agreement. The total cost is expected to be tens of billions of dollars over many years. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
Federal officials say companies are responsible for the workplace safety of employees who work from their homes. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration says employees must work in places that meet federal health and safety standards, regardless of whether they're at home or in a company building. That implies that companies must ensure that home workers have safe equipment, good lighting and ventilation, and ergonomically correct desks and chairs. OSHA stressed that the announcement isn't new policy, but just a clarification of existing rules. Business groups have said the rules put a greater legal burden on employers and could discourage telecommuting and other at-home work arrangements. Former Senator Bill Bradley and Vice President Al Gore campaigned in New Hampshire today, a day before a televised debate in the first-in-the-nation primary state. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The two Democratic presidential hopefuls will debate Wednesday night in New Hampshire and Saturday in Iowa. In preparation, they're trying out themes and approaches as they campaign. Despite pledges to keep their campaigns on the high road, both have gone on the attack, at least indirectly. Bradley makes references to those who have spent too long in Washington, D.C., and who propose tinkering around the edges of problems such as access to health care. Gore's response is that it's Bradley who's thinking too small, with a plan for fixing the health care system that leaves the country helpless to tackle other national priorities. The two are likely to step up their accusations tomorrow night about whose vision is too small, though neither wants to be labeled as a negative campaigner. New Hampshire's primary is less than a month away. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News.
Stock prices closed sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 359 points to close at 10,998. Declines led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Israel and the Palestinians signed an agreement today that outlines how Israel will withdraw Israeli troops from another 5% of the West Bank before the weekend. The agreement calls for Israel to transfer control of about 2% of the West Bank around the town of Ramallah to full Palestinian control. Israel will open another 3% of the land to shared control with the Palestinian Authority. Christians buried their dead in southern Egypt after a rampage of sectarian killing and looting over the past 4 days. Meanwhile, Egypt's prime minister assembled his key cabinet ministers to discuss how to quell further violence in the country. Dale Gavlak reports from Cairo.
A Coptic Orthodox bishop conducted funerals for 20 Christians that were killed in some of the worst sectarian violence Egypt has witnessed in two decades. An argument over finances between a Christian shopkeeper and a Muslim last Friday spiraled out of control, leading to death and destruction in the village of El Kush and surrounding hamlets 250 miles south of Cairo. The prime minister said his team would discuss radical solutions to prevent a repeat of such sectarian violence. State security officials from Cairo are investigating the matter. So far, neither the government nor the Coptic Church have issued any official statements. The health ministry has sent a team of surgeons to treat the nearly 50 wounded. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Cairo.
A federal appeals court has approved Bell Atlantic's plan to offer long-distance phone service in New York State. The company's rivals said Bell shouldn't have access to the $100 billion market because it hasn't completely allowed its competition into its market for local phone service. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been nearly 4 years since Congress voted to reform the welfare system and replace the cash safety net with a program of time limits and work requirements. Advocates predicted the new system would increase the dignity and self-respect of poor people. Critics said it would increase their poverty and desperation. My guest Jason DeParle has spent the past year monitoring the changes in the state that has come closest to eliminating welfare, Wisconsin. A decade ago, 100,000 Wisconsin families relied on public aid. Now only 7,000 do. DeParle has been reporting on welfare for the past 10 years and has joined us several times to discuss his findings. I asked him why he chose to monitor Wisconsin.
The program there is particularly interesting. It's both stricter than any program that came before. It's got the toughest work requirement. You've probably heard a lot of people talking about putting welfare recipients to work. In Wisconsin, there basically are no exceptions. Anybody who is getting cash assistance has to be in some kind of work program in exchange. So on the one hand, it's tougher than most other welfare programs. On the other hand, it's also more generous. The state has invested tens and tens of millions of dollars into creating community service jobs for people to work at, in providing them with child care, health care, wage supplements of several thousand dollars a year. So the program itself is the most ambitious, and the results are the most far-reaching.
Well, you know, in the final article in your year-long series on Milwaukee, you wrote, "Whatever else can be said about Wisconsin's crusade to end welfare, the effort achieved two things. It left far fewer people on welfare and put more people to work." But you found a big surprise. What was the surprise?
Well, the big surprise to me is that it made less difference, either for good or for bad, than we would have expected. I started covering the welfare reform debate, as it was, in 1991, when Bill Clinton first gave a speech saying "end welfare as we know it." And for the next 5 years, following the policy debate here in Washington, you ended up living inside this world where welfare was seemed to be synonymous with all the problems of the inner city. It was synonymous with poverty. It was synonymous with drug abuse. It was synonymous with educational failure, with crime. And this idea kind of grew rhetorically. Somehow, ending welfare would be ending all those other things, in the view of the proponents of it, or maybe even making all those other things worse. But it grew into, you got this sense that it was going to make a big impact one way or the other, with that the whole inner city revolved around welfare. And I think the farther you go into people's lives, the people that I met who were either currently or previously on welfare, you got the sense that welfare was just one of many things going on in their life. And they had, both economically, that they had lots of other ways of supporting themselves financially. A lot of them were working already, often secretly, so that their benefits wouldn't get cut. They had boyfriends who helped to support them. They had other government programs like disability payments and food stamps, so that economically their lives weren't as oriented as fully around welfare as we tended to assume here in Washington in describing the policy debate. And socially, there were just a lot of other things going on in their lives. One woman that I've gotten to know made a very successful economic transition off of welfare, yet her kids are rarely in school, and she's having a lot of problems with her boyfriend. And if you took a snapshot of her life while she was on welfare and a snapshot of her life after welfare, I don't think you would feel differently about the future prospects of her kids one way or the other.
Well, along those lines, one of the goals of ending welfare as we know it was to instill a sense of dignity and self-respect among people who were poor and on welfare. And as you say, President Clinton said, work is more than just a weekly paycheck. It is at heart our way of life. Work lends purpose and dignity to our lives, instills in our children the basic values that built our nation. Is there any way of measuring how trying to end welfare has affected dignity and self-respect among the poor?
I tend to be emotionally and sentimentally very appreciative of that sentiment, of that idea that work will inspire the people themselves, the workers themselves and their children. But I have to say that in my reporting, in getting to know people, I've found that that may be an idea that has a more appeal to us middle-class reformers than perhaps it does to them. There are some people who were getting welfare and were happy to be getting welfare and wanted the welfare and saw no shame or no stigma in the welfare. But deep down, I think a lot of the people on the welfare rolls were depressed about it. I mean, they don't live outside the same sort of social constructs that the rest of us live in, and they sort of feel like being on welfare isn't something to be very happy about. So getting off, having their own money, yeah, you do hear people say that all the time. This is my money. I'm not on welfare. But trying to take that deeper into whether it's really translated into gains for their kids, I rarely found a child who perceived this as bringing some special kind of new meaning to their life. Often the kids themselves felt like their mothers were just more stressed out. They had less time to help them with their homework. They had less time to put a meal on the table. And the jobs themselves are not the kinds of jobs that, well, the president talks about work gives meaning and structure and dignity to your life. A lot of these jobs are really conflict-ridden. So they're, particularly if you're in dealing with the public at all, if you think about, say, a fast food job, you're standing somewhere all day long getting yelled at because the fries are cold or the service is slow. So moving into the workplace isn't as deeply rewarding spiritually, I think, as we would like to hope it is.
One of the things you found, though, was that the changes in welfare and the attempts to get people off the welfare rolls is having a big effect on grandmothers. What effect is it having on grandmothers?
Yeah, well, the population on welfare was always composed of several different subgroups. And there was a group of women who were particularly troubled and who predominantly had drug problems. With a welfare check, they got just enough money. They could pay the rent and kind of keep the household together. When they lost, under the new system in Wisconsin, you have to go to work in order to get the welfare check. You have to show up at a work program every day. So these women typically couldn't pull it together to get down there and get their checks, get down there and show up for the work program every day. They would lose their checks. And usually what would happen to the kids in a situation like that is they'd go to live with the grandmothers. The moms would be off on the streets somewhere or in a shelter or with a boyfriend, and grandma would get the kids. So you have a group of women in Milwaukee who are rather young grandmothers, typically in their late 30s or early 40s, who feel like they just finally got done raising their own two or three or four or five kids, and they're now starting all over with often particularly unruly kids if they've grown up in chaotic households and have often typically have emotional problems and need a lot of social services and have been dumped onto these grandmothers who are all running around pulling their hair out now.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jason DeParle, and for the past 10 years, he's been reporting for the New York Times on welfare. For the past year, he reported on welfare in Wisconsin, which is the state he describes as the state that's come closest to the goal of ending welfare. Could you just review for us some of the rules in Wisconsin for welfare that have taken effect since that 1996 welfare reform program?
Well, there's one rule that matters, and that is if you get a cash assistance, you're supposed to be enrolled in a work program and working 30 hours a week. And supposed to be doing something else with your other 10 hours in some kind of education program or the like. So women in Milwaukee, in women in Wisconsin, Milwaukee's now 85% of the state's caseload lives in Milwaukee, are supposed to be working typically at like a nonprofit agency, sweeping the floors, answering the phones, something like that in exchange for a welfare check.
And when women found out that they'd have to work about 30 hours a week in order to get a welfare check, what was the attitude that you encountered?
The city is filled with people who voted with their feet, said, never mind, I'll go get a job on my own. The idea of working for a welfare check, I think most people experience as very insulting. And that's why 9 out of 10 no longer do it. At one point, there were nearly 100,000 families on welfare in Wisconsin. Now there's something like 7,700. Basically, anybody who had other options, and most people did, took them rather than work in exchange for a welfare check.
Why was that seen as such an insulting thing to ask?
That's a good question. Well, number one, you can make more money doing something else. Wisconsin raised its grant substantially when it put in the new work rules with the idea that if we're going to make people work, we ought to reward them for it. But still, it's only up to $673 a month. So most people, even if they get a entry-level job, can make substantially more than that on their own. And I think, as I was saying earlier, there's a sense of slight shame of being on welfare. People don't, if it's easy and you don't have to do anything for it, I think people will take the check. But if you've got to actually be out pushing a broom or doing something in exchange for a welfare check, people feel like, hey, I can do better than that for myself.
So when people thought, well, I don't want to do this kind of demeaning job for so little pay, I'd rather get a real job, were there real jobs to be gotten?
Oh, there certainly are in Milwaukee. I mean, the answer to that question is going to vary place by place. Of course, the economy as a whole right now is very, very strong in Milwaukee. It's particularly strong. I mean, anybody can get a job in Milwaukee. You really can. There's the reason that if people aren't working, it's not because the jobs aren't there. It's because their own lives are in such a state that they can't get to the job, whether it's a problem like a child care or a sick relative or a drug addiction or a transportation problem. It's all, you know, getting the people to the jobs, but employers themselves are desperate. Early on in the summer of 1997, when they were making the transition to the new program, I was in an office where they were kind of doing a mass sorting of people, bringing them into this office, and they had... It was, raise your hand if you want to work at the bingo. They needed people, I think, to, it was a housekeeping job at a big Indian bingo place in Milwaukee. Raise your hand, and 10 people, okay, well, we got those jobs, and they would just put them in a bus, and you're hired, go here. Raise your hand if you want to go to this nursing home. It was just, I mean, they were handing out jobs like it was lollipops. I mean, the jobs, this isn't to say the jobs are good or that they last or that they pay well or that they're necessarily full time, but just a job itself. Yes, anybody can get a job in Milwaukee at this point.
My guest is Jason DeParle, and he's been writing about welfare for the past 10 years for the New York Times. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jason DeParle, and he's been reporting on welfare for the New York Times for the past 10 years. He just concluded a year-long series on welfare in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He describes Wisconsin as the state that's come closest to the goal of ending welfare. How successful have women who were formerly on welfare been in holding down the jobs that they've gotten?
Well, that's the big thing you see. It's basically everybody has worked at some point. The surveys are pretty consistent that something like 80 to 85% of the people who have left the roles have worked at some point. And about two-thirds of them are working at any given point. But the jobs really don't last. You'll find people who will work two, three, four jobs in a given year, and they quit for all kinds of reasons: a sick child at home, childcare, the problems, the sort of structural barrier problems that liberals would typically talk about: lack of childcare, lack of transportation. That's part of it. My own experience, I'd probably say the bigger part of it tends to be people's own spirits flag. They get tired and they just stop going in. They get in a fight with the boss. They have a boyfriend who's got a drug problem and throws the house into new chaos. They have a drug problem that throws the house into new chaos. One of the things that surprised me the most, or maybe I shouldn't say surprised, but reminded me or deepened my understanding of the most this year, was the levels of depression that you find among poor single mothers in the inner city. That was really striking. Lots and lots of people are just depressed a lot of the time and can't keep getting up and going to the same job day in, day out.
So how does a caseworker or a social worker respond to that kind of depression? Do they recommend antidepressants, counseling? What are some of the recommendations?
The casework in Milwaukee runs the gamut from very, very good, extraordinarily good in a few rare instances, to really quite awful. I was in a class where they're supposed to be giving people job counseling. This was a couple of years ago, and the caseworker spent most of the class reading from an almanac of occupations, and he was supposed to be telling women what jobs were available to them and how to go get them. And instead, he was reading descriptions like mathematics. Yeah, that gets deep when you think about mathematics. Agriculture, that thing with cows, that's deep, man. And just went on in a monologue like that. And that was, that was essentially the casework in Milwaukee.
Hmm.
Most people don't have much of a relationship. If you ask me what is the typical norm, most people really don't have a relationship with their caseworker. So the caseworker, if you're asking what would a caseworker typically do in that situation, the caseworker probably would be, in a typical situation, the caseworker would be the last person to know.
Hmm. Getting back to the idea of depression, I had asked if the caseworkers recommend antidepressants or counseling. Poor people have every reason to be depressed in a lot of ways. I mean, it gets into this larger question about when depression should be treated psychologically and when it's a kind of normal reaction to the world that you live in.
Well, I did a story this year about sexual abuse. This is a sort of subset of depression. I was astonished in getting to know people in Milwaukee how many people said they had been sexually abused as children.
Mm-hmm.
We started the year by sitting in on a class, a two-week kind of self-esteem and job preparation class for women on welfare. I got to know about seven of them well. Of the seven, five said they had been sexually abused as children. Or excuse me, I think four said they had been sexually abused as children, and the fifth told me her husband was in prison for sexually abusing her child. Epidemic, I think, is not too strong a word to use about the levels of childhood sexual abuse that you encounter in poor, single-parent families. And that plays out in some really profound ways in their life with depression. I mean, that is one source of the depression. Obviously, there are others, but the depression was really widespread and quite debilitating. As for what the system does about it, it doesn't really factor it in. The W-2 is the name of the Wisconsin program. It was set up to be a work program. It rejected the idea, I think what was seen as a failed liberal idea, that counseling, education, traditional social services, preparing people for the workforce, was in any way effective. The underlying premise behind W-2 is really that work itself is therapy. If you're depressed, you'll feel better about yourself by getting up and going to work. It's really just geared towards getting people jobs. It's not geared toward providing these ancillary social services. The more it's evolved, and as the caseload now has gotten down to such a minuscule proportion of what it once was, and there's all this money left in the system, it's moving in that direction. But that was a sort of after-the-fact discovery. I mean, the program itself isn't set up to be a psychological counseling program.
I think one of the goals of trying to end welfare as we know it has been to stop a cycle of, you know, generations within families being on welfare. And I'm wondering, from all the time you've spent observing families on welfare, do you think that that assumption was true in the first place, you know, that generation after generation is on welfare, that welfare leads to the next generation being on welfare? And although it's a little too early to tell, do you think that this program seems to be heading in a direction that would end that cycle?
Yeah, well, we all hope that a child who grows up in a working family is going to see an example of discipline set, and is going to that is going to inspire them to stay in school, work hard, and strive harder for success themselves. Certainly an idea that intuitively appeals to me and appeals to most people, I think, who support welfare reform. What I found in looking in the families that I got to know is that that idea didn't play out in quite the straight way that we would have expected. That lots of the people that I got to know on welfare themselves had grown up in families that were not on welfare. They'd grown up typically with single parents, almost always with single mothers, almost always with low-income single mothers. Now, some of those mothers worked. Some of them were on welfare. Some of them went back and forth between work and welfare. But if you're asking what's the more powerful factor in determining their lives, is that they stayed poor, whether they were working or not. They didn't really have enough money to get out of the central city, to get into a different place, and they didn't have a father around to help them. So whether their mom was working from 10 o'clock at night to 6 o'clock in the morning for 20 years, as one woman that I got to know has done, this is a woman who would spend all night, every night, as a hospital housekeeper. She had five kids, so she's the sort of paradigm of a hardworking family. She's what we want to get with this welfare reform rule, is rules are kind of geared up to get us back to. That's what we want to create, right? A hard work. A woman spends 20 years giving her kids the example, the dignity of her work. It's certainly an admirable example that she set, but she had five children, and four of them wound up with bad drug problems, and two of them are in jail. So the merely getting single parents into low-wage jobs, it may, on balance, help some of their children, but I didn't come away with this feeling that it's going to radically change the prospects of their kids' lives.
Jason DeParle writes about welfare for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support from the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're listening to an instrumental track from the new CD by singer-songwriter and guitarist Marshall Crenshaw. Coming up, he'll perform songs from the CD, which is called Number 447. And we'll continue our conversation about welfare with Jason DeParle of the New York Times.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with New York Times reporter Jason DeParle, who has written about welfare for the past 10 years. He just completed a year-long study of Wisconsin, the state that has come closest to the goal of ending welfare. Part of the 1996 Welfare Reform Act was that the federal welfare money would actually be turned over to the states. So states have more federal money than they ever did before for poverty-related programs. What are some of the surprises that you found in how the states are actually using this money?
The states are using it in every way imaginable. I would have to give Wisconsin credit as directing most of it back toward programs for low-income people. They have a very generous tax credit system there. There's now a set of federal tax credits. They're called tax credits, so it's just kind of a misleading way of describing them. What they really are is wage bonuses. They're annual payments. They're not just a reduction in your taxes. They're actually a check from the government. So under the federal system now, you can get up to $3,700 a year, depending on the number of kids you have and how much you earn, as an annual wage supplement for low-income workers. Well, Wisconsin layered on top of that their own tax credit system. So if you're making $10,000-$12,000 in Wisconsin, you between the state and federal tax credits, you can end up with something like a $5,000 check at the end of the year. That's one productive thing that I think Wisconsin did with the money. They've also put a lot of money into child care. They're trying to now set up a health care system so that if you leave welfare, you can be assured that you keep health care for your family. Wisconsin's probably at one extreme of investing heavily in the program. The opposite extreme is probably a place like New Mexico, which has lots of federal money, like all states do now, because the federal money stayed fixed, even though the number of welfare families declined substantially. And in New Mexico, 2 or 3 years after the federal legislation passed, they still were in the process of trying to let the contracts, and really no new services had been put in place. One thing I think you do find as a common denominator among the states is that the federal funding was set for 5 years, so it expires in 2001, now just around the corner. So all the states have a surplus because their rolls are gone down. They've gotten the same amount of federal money, but the federal money is only guaranteed for 5 years, so the states are very reluctant to set up ongoing new programs that they feel like then the federal government's going to take away the money and they're going to be left having to support them out of state dollars. So,
well, what happens when the 5 years is up? Do the states
well,
to get
knows.
Any federal funding?
What happens is Congress has to decide again, and they've already been trying. There have been several moves to take away some of the money. That's one of the big surprises of the whole welfare deal. When it was the 1996 legislation was presented as a welfare cut. It was scored as saving federal money. What it really did was it kept the federal funding constant for 5 years. In the past, it had always grown as the caseloads grew. Now it was capped, and the caseloads fell. So some states are, Wisconsin, again, because its caseloads have fallen so far as an extreme example, but they're getting something like $30,000 a year per welfare family, where they used to get something like $5,000 a year. Wisconsin, you know, again, that's an extreme example, but all the states are getting much, much more on a per-case basis than they were in the past. Seeing all that money out there, the budget hawks in Congress have already made several moves to go and try to take some of it back. They've been rebuffed by the Republican governors who said, hey, we had a deal. This was supposed to be kept in place for 5 years. But while nobody exactly knows what's going to happen at the end of the 5 years, everybody expects the federal money will be cut back substantially.
My guest is Jason DeParle. He's a reporter for the New York Times, and he's been reporting on welfare for the past 10 years. He just ended a year-long series on welfare in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He describes Wisconsin as the state that's come closest to the goal of ending welfare. Do you think that the end of welfare as we knew it has affected the class system in Milwaukee, where you were observing it, or in the rest of the country where you've been keeping close tabs?
Well, I'm not sure I know what you mean by the effect of the class system, but I would say that it's affected the society's view toward the poor. I mean, there's much less anger right now, I think. If there's one thing that I would say has been one of the more encouraging aspects of the end of welfare, I don't know if it's made a big difference for poor people themselves, but it seems to have changed the sort of spirit towards poor people. You know, the 1996 welfare debate got very ugly at times. I can't prove this, but when you talk to business people, when you talk to politicians, I get the sense that there's a desire to cut the poor a break now that they're when people go from being seen as welfare recipients to workers, I think that makes a big difference in how the body politic will respond to them. Mm-hmm. You know, in the same year, the year after welfare reform passed, as part of a balanced budget, and so the welfare reform legislation passed in 96. In 97, a Republican Congress, in the process of balancing a budget, passed a $24 billion program to subsidize health insurance for the children of low-income workers. So, the previous year it had passed this legislation, which seemed to take away tens of billions of dollars in welfare-related benefits. The following year, once the subject became not welfare recipients but low-wage workers, the result was quite different. So, I'm modestly optimistic that you can build a more supportive politics around the idea of people going to work. I mean, certainly, the welfare system was a dead end politically. You just couldn't get any more support for it.
Well, one last question. Part of the reason why you chose Wisconsin as the state to study was that you thought it offered a good preview of what the rest of the country is in store for. So if we look at Milwaukee, the city in Wisconsin that you focused on, if we look at Milwaukee as the preview, what do you think the rest of us are in store for?
Well, going back to the 96 debate again, remember there was all this talk that there were going to be children on the streets. This was going to be an apocalypse. The cities were going to burn. I think what you found in Milwaukee is, by and large, you know, the absence of the disaster scenario. You found higher levels than you would have expected of employment. And I think, subjectively, that the deeper you go into people's lives, you find that it's made less difference. So I think, on the whole, you'll have a surface story of seeming success as long as the economy stays strong. People leave welfare, find jobs, don't fall, by and large, most of them, into abject destitution. Does it deeply transform their lives? Does it make their kids stand tall and proud? Does it lead them onto some escalator of economic and social uplift? I'm somewhat pessimistic that we're going to see that.
So is your conclusion that ending welfare as we know it isn't going to be sufficient to end poverty and to end the problems faced by people who are poor, that there are other reforms as well that need to be put into place, other ways of addressing the issue?
Yeah, I think welfare reform has given us so far, at least in Milwaukee, is a good start. You can't envision a solution, both either economic or socially, that doesn't include people having a job. I mean, you got to at least start there. You're not going to... it's a necessary condition of their economic and social progress. What I'd also like to add is it's not necessarily a sufficient answer to their problems. And I think that's where I see the proponents of welfare reform being too quick to just congratulate themselves and say, see, people didn't die on the streets, it worked, they have jobs, you know, let's all pack it up and go home and call it a success. I think it's a good first step.
Well, Jason DeParle, I want to thank you for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Jason DeParle writes about welfare for the New York Times. Last week, he completed his year-long series on Wisconsin's efforts to end welfare. Coming up, singer, songwriter, and guitarist Marshall Crenshaw performs songs from his new CD. This is Fresh Air. Marshall Crenshaw is a songwriter, singer, and guitarist known for writing pop songs with catchy hooks. His first album was described in Rolling Stone as 1982's most gorgeous singer-songwriter debut. Our rock critic Ken Tucker described a later album as the most blissfully pure pop rock album in ages. Crenshaw is also the author of the 1993 book Hollywood Rock, a survey of rock and roll movies. In the movie La Bamba, about rock star Ritchie Valens, Crenshaw played Buddy Holly. We invited Marshall Crenshaw to perform some songs from his new CD, which is called Number 447. Marshall Crenshaw, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here in the studio. Why don't you start with a song from your new CD, 447?
Well, all right, I will. I'll do just that. And it's nice to see you, Terry. This is called Dime a Dozen Guy. It starts like this. Well, I saw her Sunday down by the breakers. She drove right by me. I was stunned to realize that she was riding with that dime a dozen guy. First they're at the Forum, and then they're at the drive-in. Well, I asked my buddies, and they all said it's no lie. She's tearing up the town with that dime a dozen guy. I guess I was thoughtless, careless too. I disappeared on her, it's true. Now I realize I wasted something that I cared about. That's why I'm blue. Well, he's not good looking, at least I don't think so. I just can't figure any earthly reason why a girl like her would choose that dime a dozen guy. Is there something about him that my eyes aren't seeing? If I'm not mistaken, then there's no way to deny that I've been left in the dust for a dime a dozen guy. Right now it's feeling pretty grim to hang my heart out on this limb. Now I realize I wasted something that I cared about, and she's with him. Well, I saw her Sunday down by the breakers. She drove right past me, smiled as she rode by. Another girl in love with a dime a dozen guy. Yeah, he's a dime a dozen guy.
It's Marshall Crenshaw performing a song from his new CD. The CD is called 447, or number 447.
Number 447. That's how I always say it.
All right. A catchy title, if ever there was one. Oh, Marshall, that's a great song. It's my favorite from the new CD. And the title is such a good hook, Dime a Dozen Guy. Is that what came first in the song?
No, not really. I wrote the song with a guy in New York named David Cantor. And the two of us really didn't know each other all that well. We kind of had one brief conversation in a bar one time, but I'd heard this song that he wrote called Florida Time, which is an unknown song, but it actually should be a popular song because it's really cool. It's just a guy on death row kind of musing about his fate, but it's like the song captures this really, really dark humor. And so we had a mutual friend, and we agreed to get together and write a song. And the first thing that came together was I just sort of said, well, let's try this groove on the drum machine, which was kind of like doom ta oom ta oom. And then he started going, And it just sort of built up from there. And I came up with the title. I don't know why it popped into my head, but and then he came up with a lot of those lyrics. There's a lot of detail in the lyrics, you know, like down by the breakers, and first they're at the Forum, and then they're at the drive-in, and it kind of sounds like a town on the Jersey Shore or something in 1958. And so, yeah, the song's got a lot of atmosphere. I give him most of the credit for the lyrics.
I like he's not so handsome. At least I don't think so.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's supposed to be a humorous song, basically.
My guest is Marshall Crenshaw, and he has a new CD, which is called Number 447. If you don't mind my asking, I'm wondering what it's been like for you to get older while playing rock and roll. You know, because you came of age at the time when parents were saying, well, rock and roll is just a passing phase anyways. And, you know, when everybody gets older, they'll be listening to Steve and Edie Gourmet.
Yeah.
Which, of course, wasn't true. But
well, it's kind of true in my case.
Actually, yeah, you like Edie Gourmet.
Yeah, I named a song on my album after Edie Gourmet. There's a song on the record called Edie's Tune, which is an instrumental. And, you know, it's got a sort of a, like a torch ballad thing about it, you know. So I thought of all those singers from the 50s like Chris Connor and Julie London. And then there's this one album called Edie Gourmet Swings the Blues, which is a pretty good album from back then. So Edie's Tune in honor of Edie Gourmet.
Gee, should you do a few bars of Edie's Tune while we're talking about it?
I can't. Maybe you could play a little snatch of it. You
That's
know.
A better idea. Well, here, why don't we play an excerpt of Edie's Tune from Marshall's new CD, Number 447. There's so many different age groups and audiences now that rock and roll is the dominant music in American culture. It's no longer just teenage music, but
yeah.
Teenagers listen to different rock and roll than people in their 30s or 40s or 50s do. Do you feel like you have a certain, you know, age that mostly listens to you? And I'm just wondering some of your thoughts about age and rock and roll now.
Well, you know, honestly, I think it's kind of lost its preeminence. You know, it's lost its commercial dominance, that's for sure.
You mean rock has?
Yeah,
you
I mean
it's more
really
like hip-hop now?
Well, no, I wouldn't really put the... I don't think anything's really taken over, you know? I was making my records in the 80s, you know? That was a time when you could really seriously make a fortune doing it, you know? I don't know if that was so true in the 60s, you know? It seems like the business was sort of unsophisticated, more of an outlaw business in the 60s. Than it became later on, you know. But it's still sort of an outlaw business.
You haven't made a fortune, I don't think.
Not really.
Performing.
No, I haven't. But I've gotten lucky a couple times. Just enough to make me know how amazing it is when you have a hit, just how much the money tree gets shaken.
What was your song that made the most money?
I wrote this one called You're My Favorite Waste of Time. And I just like kind of made it up in my head in about 20 minutes and... It got covered by Bette Midler, and but her version of it wasn't such a huge hit. And then a few years later, it got covered by this guy in England called Owen Paul, you know, a one-hit wonder. And but it was huge. It got to be like number three. And then so from that day until this, it still gets played on the radio all the time over in Europe, and it's been covered around the world. About every 2.5 years, there's another version of it. So that's sort of like, you know, the one that's kind of had the longest shelf life and made the most money. And then I wrote a tune with the Gin Blossoms a couple of years ago that was really big. So a couple of times I've gotten lucky. had a couple hits.
Play a chorus of one of those two songs for us.
Okay, you're my favorite waste of time. You're my honey, you're my favorite waste of time. Yeah, you're my, oh, you're my favorite waste of time. Well, I don't care if being with you is meaningless and ridiculous, if it's wrong or right. Got to give you my love tonight and tomorrow night, 'cause you're mine. Yeah, you're my favorite waste of time. You're my favorite. Oh, baby, you're my favorite waste of time. And it just kind of goes on and on like that.
So it's really unpredictable what's going to happen to a song after you write it.
That's what I love about it, you know? It's just, things sneak up on you sometimes, you know? That's the cool thing. It makes life interesting.
My guest is Marshall Crenshaw. He has a new CD called Number 447. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is songwriter, singer, and guitarist Marshall Crenshaw. He has a new CD called Number 447. I want to ask you to close with a song from the new CD. So play another one of your songs for us from the new CD. I chose the first one, so I'll let you choose this one.
Okay. This one's called Truly, Madly, Deeply. And, you know, I was like a sort of embarrassed or uneasy about having that as the song title. So on the album, I put TMD, you know, I don't know why. But
Wait. What's embarrassing about Truly, Madly, Deeply?
You know, I hadn't seen the film, you know, so I didn't really know necessarily what association that might have, you know, the phrase. I co-wrote the song with a guy named Bill Demain, and he came up with the title. And then there was a Savage Garden song a few years ago called Truly, Madly, Deeply. I didn't want anybody to get my song confused with that one. But I love the song, you know, the way it came out. It's like Bill has this group called Swan Dive, and they're really popular in Japan. You know, they're based in Nashville, but they sell lots of records in Japan. And so as we were writing it, that just sort of got me thinking about these Japanese pop songs that I know. I don't know very many, but I know a bunch by this group called Shonen Knife. And they write songs where they kind of celebrate everyday things, you know. They just write about their surroundings and stuff. So we kind of did that with this tune. I watch you cross the street among the midday crowd. You wouldn't hear me if I called your name, so I wait. I love to be downtown. That's where the good times are. And when your eyes find mine, I see that look on your face. Every once in a while, I know something to be nothing else but true. And right here and now, I do. We can
gets the silver skyline reflected on the water. The autumn air is filled with memories and possibilities, and how the hours fly by. 'Cause life is all around us, so much to talk and laugh about between you and me. Oh, it feels so fine to know you got something more than what you might dream of. And right here and now, I know that I'm truly, madly, deeply in love. Every once in a while, I know something to be nothing else but true.
Marshall Crenshaw performing his song Truly, Madly, Deeply. His new CD is called Number 447. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Kathy Wolf. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Dell, publisher of The Complete Book of Food Counts, 5th edition by Corinne T. Netzer. Counting Carbs, a book that counts carbs, fats, and proteins for people watching what they eat. Available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Barbara Sonnenborn, director of the documentary Regret to Inform, about women whose husbands were killed in the war in Vietnam. She became a war widow in 1968. Her film will be shown later this month on PBS. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.